सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Good. Welcome back. We're continuing our study of chapter 13. We've just begun. We're kind of stuck on verses 1 and 2 for a very, very good reason. We'll discuss that in just a moment. Let's begin with some chanting. Repeat after me, please.
Arjuna Vacha, Arjuna, Prakritam Purusham Chaiva, Prakritam Purusham Kshetram Kshetrajnam Eva Cha, Kshetram Kshetrajnam Eva. Etad veditum et chami, etad veditum et cha. Jnanam geyam cha keshava, jnanam geyam cha keshava. Shri Bhagavan uvacha, Shri Bhagavan. Iram shariram kaunteya, iram shariram kshetramitya vidhiyate, kshetramitya vidhiyate. Etad yo veti tam prahuhu, etad yo kshetrajna hyati tadviraha, kshetrajna hyati tadviraha, kshetrajnam chapi mam vidhi, kshetrajnam chapi sarva kshetreshu bharata, sarva kshetra. Kshetra kshetrajna yor jnanam, kshetra kshetrajna yor yattad jnanam matam mama, yattad jnanam tat kshetram yaccha yadrakcha, tat kshetram yaccha tadvikari yatascha yat, yadvikari sacha yo yat prabhavascha, sacha yo yat tatsamasena me shrinu, tatsamasena me shrinu rishibhir bahudha gitam, rishibhir bahudha chando bhir vividai pratak, chando bhir vividai Brahma Sutra Padaish Chaiva, Brahma Sutra Padaish Hetu Madhir Vinishchitaihi, Hetu Madhir Vinishchitaihi Mahabhutanyahankaro, Mahabhutan Buddhiravyaktam Evacha, Buddhirav Indriyani dashaikam cha, Indriyani dashaik pancha chendriya gocharaha, pancha chendriya gocharaha Iccha dvesha sukha dukham, Iccha dvesha Sanghatas chetana dhritihi, Sanghatas chetana Etat kshetram samasena, etat savikaram udahritam, savikaram udahritam, amanitvam adambhitvam, amanitvam adam, ahimsa kshantirajavam, ahimsa Acharyopasanam shaucham, Acharyopasanam sthairamatma vinigraha, sthairamatma vinigraha, indriyarteshu vairagyam, indriyarteshu vai anahankara hevacha, anahankara Janma mrityujara vyadhi, janma mrityujara dukkha doshanudarshanam, dukkha doshanudarshanam asaktir anabhishvangaha, asaktir anabhishvang putradara grahadishu, putradara nityancha samachit tattvam nityam ishtanishtopapattishu ishtanishtopapattishu.
Very good. So, let us go all the way back, because we're still getting started in this chapter. This chapter, as we've discussed in previous classes, starts with the most amazing Vedantic unfoldment in a short span of two verses. It's amazing. You know, a verse is very short. A verse is 32 syllables. All of these verses, most of these verses, are in the Anushubh Chandas. They have 16 syllables in a line, which means you can't say much in a line. Here, in this is really the first verse. Remember, we've discussed before how what's labeled here as verse 1 is really not part of the Bhagavad Gita. This is added by some traditional pundit scholars, and it sets the context for the chapter. The chapter is an answer, the chapter is Lord Krishna's answer to three pairs of questions. And the questions were what is Prakriti and Purusha? What is Kshetra and Kshetrajna? And what is Jnanam and Jnayam? These three pairs of questions. So, what is really verse 1 of the chapter, Sri Krishna begins this profound inquiry into Kshetra and Kshetrajna. Kshetra, field of experience. Whatever you experience. Kshetrajna, the knower of the field of experience. These two words encompass everything. And that's not figuratively said. Is there anything that doesn't fall into one of these two categories? The basic way of understanding these two categories, there's a word, is knower and known. Kshetrajna is the knower of the field of experience, simply the knower. Kshetram is the field of experience, the known. In addition to you, the knower, and everything else that is known, is there any third category in the entire universe? That's it. Everything in the universe is going to fall under one or the other of these headings. Or, as we said in the two classes ago when we began our study, it's either Atma or Anatma. It's either you or it's not you. That's it. What a simple analysis. Everything in the cosmos can be brought under these two headings, you and not you. Self and not self. Atma and Anatma. Then, just recall one of the most important discussions we had in introducing the chapter is the fact that this distinction is not merely a philosophical distinction. Not merely. Yes, it is a philosophical distinction, but not merely a philosophical distinction, because the failure to correctly separate knower and known in an odd way ends up being the root of all of our problems. Really and truly, the root of suffering is a failure to discriminate between self and not self. And just to, and I know when you hear that, it sounds so abstract and you wonder, how can that be? How can the source of all my suffering be the failing to discriminate between me and not me? It sounds very abstract. It sounds, the fancy modern term is counterintuitive. It doesn't click right away. But then we gave a series of examples, just a brief review, and then we'll proceed with important new material today. Remember the examples I gave, like your car. When your car gets dented, you got upset. If you got dented and you got upset, I would understand. You're not dented, your car is dented. The car is a thing, it's not you. But here comes the problem of identification. It's not just a car. It's my car. There's a problem. Remember the analysis where I asked you, please tell me, you can tell me in your code, how does that go? You can point out in your car. If I ask you where the engine is, you can show me the engine. If I ask you where the spare tire is, you can show me where the spare tire is. Okay. If I ask you where the minus of your car is, where will you point? The place to point, of course, is not in the car. The place to point is right here. This is what we mean by this fundamental confusion about self and not self, but a confusion that leads to suffering. If a car is just a car, of course, all cell phones should be turned off before entering the hall. We had two phones go off during our meditation today, which was rather unfortunate. Anyway, if the car is just a car, then there's no issue. But it's not just a car. And this problem pervades our lives. We unwittingly empower things and individuals in our lives to hurt us. Tell me, would you give a gun to a mugger? Huh? What a ridiculous statement. Who in their right mind would empower a mugger? Someone who is out to get you. Well, we had a long discussion last week, of all things, about mothers-in-law. And a few of you who might have problems with a mother-in-law, definitely it's true that mothers-in-law can sometimes give you a hard time, but the sad truth is you unwittingly empower them, almost like giving a gun to a mugger. That is, you fail to recognize that this person is an individual person with her own problems, her own issues, her own desires, her own life, her own karma, her own everything. You are an individual person. This is an individual person. Her problems are hers. So why do you take them on yourself? Why do you empower her to affect you so much? That applies to anyone and everyone in all situations. Anyway, we talked about this in much detail in prior classes, and we gave that very powerful metaphor. We'll start with that metaphor today, and then we'll proceed. And hopefully we'll finish this verse, and we will. Today we must. We've already spent 2 days on this verse. It deserves weeks and weeks, but this is in the context of Bhagavad Gita. If this were a Vedanta class, we wouldn't be able to move on for another 5, 6, 7 classes. But this is a Bhagavad Gita class, so we're going to move on today. let's return to that movie analogy. Because it really, in a simple way, encapsulates the fundamental confusion we get. We forget that who you are is absolutely independent from all the roles we play. Let's start here. You have a profession. You might be an engineer, you might be a doctor, you might be a homemaker, you might be a mother. These are all professions. You have a profession. Is that the sum total of who you are? If you happen to be an engineer, is that who you are 24/7? No. In fact, that would be a problem. You know, with your family, it would be inappropriate to be an engineer. You can imagine what kind of confusion that would cause. Well, that happens all the time. That very confusion happens all the time. How often it is when, you know, husband and wife go off to work in the morning. So husband goes and he goes off to work and he becomes an engineer. Wife goes off to work, she becomes, say, a doctor. So she's a doctor all day long. He's an engineer all day long. Then they come home. And when she comes home, she's in the kitchen. She's back to being wife. And when he comes home, he is angry and upset because of everything that was going on at the office. He comes home and he's still engineer. This is a problem. You know, husband left in the morning, but an engineer comes home in the evening. And if he is unable to take off that engineer's role, he can take off his tie, but that's not enough. He's got to take off that engineering role and go back to being husband. And if he fails to do so, it's a source of considerable problems. Now, this is a simple story, but it shows a kind of confusion that pervades our lives and creates so much suffering. Suppose you really understood that in every situation, you are independent of the role that you play. Being doctor is a role. Being engineer is a role. You're more than that. Being husband is a role. Being wife is a role. You're more than that. Being son, daughter is a role. You're more than that. Being mother or father are roles. You're more than that. Being friend is a role. You're more. All of these are just roles. You are more than that. You are the one playing all of these roles. And if you can learn one thing, that the problems belong to the role and not to you, you will gain tremendous freedom. This is a great chance to tell one of my guru's favorite stories, of the actor and the beggar. I bet half of you have heard this story from him, and he tells it so brilliantly, and I'll tell it in a very, very simple way. Once upon a time, there was an actor on a stage, and the role of the actor was to play that of a beggar. And the beggar was supposed to, in this particular scene, the beggar was supposed to be sitting down begging. His begging bowl or whatever. And the other actor, who's supposed to be very mean, comes along and kicks the beggar sitting on the ground. The beggar is supposed to start weeping. And this is the scene. So they're on stage, all the people are sitting in the audience, and the beggar is out there begging, and the other actor comes on and starts shouting at this fellow, "You lazy, worthless bum," and kicks him. And this fellow sitting on there playing the role of beggar, he gets outraged, jumps up, "Why did you kick me? How can you?" And he starts fighting. Hey, wait a minute. He's supposed to be playing the role of beggar. He has somehow forgotten it's a role. But massive confusion ensues as they start fighting on the stage. Do you know, it's not as far-fetched as you think. When a husband comes home and he still feels like an engineer, he's still kind of fighting all these political office games, and he brings all of that with him into the home, isn't it the same kind of confusion? It's not so far-fetched. It's a role. We fail to distinguish that roles are things we take on and take off like sets of clothing. When a husband comes home, stuck in that engineer's role, he's stuck. It's like, can you imagine being stuck in a set of clothing day after day, not being able to take it off? What a problem. Anyway, finish off the story. What is a skillful actor? A skillful actor is one who never loses sight of the distinction between self and the role. Now, does it mean that the actor is always really distant and detached? And you know, this is the other mistake. And that is a mistake to think that, oh, we have to go through life being really detached and distant. This is a mistake. Think about the actor. The skillful actor is one who, playing the role begging, the other guy curses him and kicks him, and the skillful actor falls on his face and weeps. And while he's weeping, inside he's thinking, I'm doing really good today. I've got real tears coming down my cheeks. I'm really doing a great job of acting today. Maybe I'll do such a great job that I'll be able to demand more fees for my next performance. A skillful actor is one who's simultaneously completely engaged. By the way, good actors cry real tears. They know how to do that. Good actors cry real tears. But inside, they're proud of getting those tears going. This is not only the art of theater, this is an art of living. The art of living is being able to be fully engaged in our lives, knowing all the time we are separate, we are independent of all of the roles. Now, to get there is not an ordinary thing. I can tell you this simple story about the actor and the beggar and all of that, but you get it at one level. You get it at an intellect. You can understand the power and implication of these teachings. You can understand it. But to actually apply it to our lives, day to day, situation to situation, is something else entirely. It requires a lot of spiritual teaching to get us there. So let us proceed with some of the core teachings associated with this verse, the core teachings to help you get there. You can't just make it happen. You know, if some of you might be thinking, well, if I could just remember all the time it's a role. Memory is such a thing, it's not reliable. If it's only a matter of memory, it won't happen. We forget things all the time. You forget the name of your best friend occasionally, so what to say of other things? We can forget, and we forget in the most embarrassing times. Your best friend is standing there and you're introducing her to someone, and the name just won't come. So in the same way, if this distinction between you and the role depends on memory, it won't work. It can't be based on memory. What we're beginning to discuss is one of the most radical teachings of the ancient rishis, which is that the result of these spiritual teachings is nothing less than a complete transformation of your worldview. How you see yourself, how you see the world around you, how you see yourself in relationship to the world around you. This is your worldview. And these Vedantic teachings have as their goal the complete transformation of your worldview. Very radical. So how will we get there? Not with simple stories about an actor and beggar. So let's go to the core of this verse. And that'll also set the stage then, hopefully, to move on for the next verse. Let's return to this verse. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Shri Idam Shariram Kaunteya Idam Shariram Kshetramitya Vidhiyate Kshetramitya Etad Yo Veti Tam Prahuhu Etad Yo Kshetragnya Hiti Tadviraha Kshetragnya. Shri Krishna addresses Arjuna. Hey Kaunteya, O son of Kunti, O Arjuna, idam shariram, this body, kshetram, iti abhidhiyate, is called, iti, thus, abhidhiyate, is called, is termed, is designated, kshetram. This body is the kshetra. anything you can call this or that is kshetra. It's a nice way of defining things. You have two pronouns, this or that. This body, this chair, this hall, that tree outside, that sun shining that we can't see right now. So anything you can call this or that is not me. These are the way pronouns work. All right. This body, this mind, this thought. Are you following the implications of what I'm saying just now? Anything you say is a this is not an I. Two pronouns. Three. This and that, to talk about the world. This, things in the world that are nearby, proximate. That, things in the world that are not nearby, remote. We have a proximate and a remote pronoun, this and that. So, these pronouns are an absolute distinction from I, aham. I am not a this, I am not a that. Correct? I am I. That's why we have a unique pronoun for I. Now, look at the implications. Anything that's a this or a that is not I. This chair. No, obviously. This cloth. Yeah. This hair. Okay. This skin. Oh. This hand. Oh. This arm. Oh. Means it's like the chair. This chair, this arm, they're things, they're not me. This body is a thing, it's not me. This prana, this strength, this energy, this vitality, this age, not me. This power of sight, this power of hearing, taste, touch, smell, this, separate from me. This mind, this knowledge, this intellect, this memory, this collection of memory, this, not I, separate from me, not me. These emotions, this sadness, this happiness, not me. It's a this. Who am I? I. How can we understand that I? Etat yoveti. Yoveti, one who knows, etat, this. The one who knows anything called this. Who is that one? Tam prahuhu. That person is called kshetragna, the knower of the field. This is it, knower and known. You are the knower, everything else is known to you. And the most important thing we talked about before is problems that belong to the known don't belong to you. This is a fundamental issue. This is how these teachings are not mere philosophy. This is exactly how these teachings solve the problem of human suffering. When you can recognize that problems that belong to you are yours. How silly. Problems that belong to me are mine. Problems that don't belong to me are not mine. Anything profound in that? Nothing. The profundity comes in recognizing who I am and what I am not. If this body is ill, tired, and certainly every day we deal with, you know, every morning you wake up and there's one problem or another. Right? Feels that way. Something, and every day is a little different. There's this problem this day, this problem the other day. Anyway, bodies are like that. One problem or another. Not just bodies, minds, emotions. One day you have this emotional problem. Next day you have some other issue is going on in your life. These problems come, they go on changing. But suppose we really get it. Problems of the body belong to the body, not to you. Problems of your mind and emotions belong to your mind and not to you. And we started talking about this yesterday. And again, in order to do justice to this topic, we should spend another 7 classes on it. But we want to move on, so let us go to the core of these teachings, unfold it properly, and get ready to move on. This relationship between knower and known. You are the knower. Everything else is known to you. Anything known to you is not you. Now, what does that mean? And we're going to go right now to the essence of our experience. We said in a prior class that the only thing you experience directly is the contents of your mind. Remember that discussion 2 classes ago? We said that everything in the world is known to us through our 5 senses. Sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell. And these 5 senses convey to our minds an image or representation of the world around us. So our eyes pick up what happens around us, and we gave the metaphor. Our eyes pick up the image of the world and project it on the screen of the mind. Remember the metaphor? Our ears pick up sounds projected on the screen of the mind. Everything we perceive in the world is projected on the screen of your mind. Who are you? Like being in the audience in the theater, you are the one observing whatever takes place on the screen of your mind. Whatever you see, hear, taste, touch, or smell is known to you not directly, but you know what happens in your mind. So we said in a prior class, you don't see me directly. We said that at best, there are 2 quarter-inch tall swamis upside down on the back of your retina. That's the way you see me. On the back of your 2 eyeballs, the retinas, there are 2 quarter-inch tall swamis upside down. That's not what you see. You see me. Well, the me that you're seeing is in your mind, not out here. So, just imagine. This is like a open eye meditation. Keep your eyes open, but just try to get this in a non-intellectual way. Try to get this in a very experiential way. Right now, you are aware of what's happening in your mind. That's the only thing you're aware. Everything happening in this room is actually present in your mind. You're actually observing what's happening in your mind. All of us, including me, are stuck there in your mind. It's interesting. We're all crowded there inside your mind. You are the one observing all of this projected on the screen of your mind. Everything you perceive, which means everything in the world. And not only that, anything you think, all of your thoughts projected on the screen of your mind. And very importantly, all of your emotions. When you experience happiness, isn't the happiness an object of your, it's something you experience. When you're happy, you know happiness is present here in your mind. Or sadness is present here in your mind. You know when you're happy. You know when you're sad. You are the observer of all of this. Observer of everything you perceive that's projected on the screen of your mind. Observer of all of your thoughts that occur on the screen of your mind. Observer of all of your emotions that take place on the screen of your mind. Who are you? Observer. And as an observer, you are fundamentally unaffected by everything happening going on the screen of your mind. Remember the full metaphor. We said, like in a movie theater, you watch one of these thriller movies. Someone's about to get killed. It's a very scary scene. But you're sitting here in a theater. If you're absorbed in the movie, you're going to feel afraid. If the character you're watching gets killed, do you bleed? You don't bleed. Nothing really happens to you. No matter how bloody it is on the screen, nothing really happens to you. Even the fear you experience, you need not experience that fear if you choose to. If you want, if the scene is too gruesome, you just turn your eyes away from the screen. You look over there. You look over there. You look at your hands. You detach yourself from that frightening thing happening on the screen, and you have popped out of the movie, popped out of the drama. Moments before, you were absorbed in that drama, and it seemed to affect you. Remember the crystal? I won't go through all that again today, but in our last class, we gave the crystal example. The crystal seems to be affected. It's not truly affected. In the same way, when you're identified with the movie, when you're engaged or engrossed in a movie, you seem to be affected. Are you really? When a movie is over, you know, three characters have died, gruesome deaths, and you walk out of the theater the same person. Fundamentally speaking, you are not affected by anything that happens on that movie screen in the theater. In the same way, listen carefully, you, the observer, are utterly unaffected by everything happening in your mind. This is such a powerful and radical teaching of the ancient rishis. Whatever happens in your mind stays there, in your mind. It's not affecting you. Yes, I know it seems to affect you, which is why we spent half of last class talking about the crystal. We're not going to return to that. But just as in the movie theater, if you get engrossed in the movie, it seems to affect you, but it doesn't really affect you. Any moment you choose, you can detach from the movie, pop out of the movie, turn your attention away from the movie, and you realize, hey, I'm sitting here in the movie theater, I'm utterly unaffected by everything going on in the screen. This observer is what we call Sakshi Atma. It is Atma, yourself, as the Sakshi, as the awareful witness of your own mind. This is you in a more fundamental sense. That's I. The one who really deserves the pronoun I. It's not your body. The one who really deserves the pronoun I is that one. The one right now observing whatever's happening in your mind. You with me? Okay. I know this is a little challenging, but very, very important. All right. So, let's proceed now. We have to finish the movie example. This is one of my favorite ones. Because the movie you're watching, you're unaffected by this movie. But this movie, do you remember years ago when they used to have double feature movies? Nowadays they don't have. In fact, in India, your movies were 4 hours long. You couldn't have double feature movies. In this country, 30, 40 years ago, they would have double feature movies. They'd have 2 1.5-hour movies, and that would be the whole thing. So, the metaphor is delightful because it says that your life is like being in a theater watching a double feature movie. In what sense is it a double feature? Well, the first feature of the movie began this morning when we did this last class. What was the first scene of today's movie? Bedroom ceiling, scene one. And then, there was the bathroom scene, the breakfast scene, the coming to ashram scene, et cetera, et cetera. So this will go on and on and on and on and on until finally we come to the last scene of this first feature. What is the last scene? Bedroom ceiling right before you fall asleep. Okay. That's the end of the first feature. Now comes the second feature in this double feature movie. What is that? Dream. You start dreaming. And it's a whole different thing. different plots, different characters, right? Different set. You know, the set of the first feature is New Jersey. The set of the second feature could be India, right? So, and different characters, obviously. So, first feature is still going on. Remember, you're in a theater. You're watching this first feature play out in your own mind. You are independent. Get that image. Sitting in a movie theater, separate from what you're watching on the screen. You, as Sakshi, are that observer, independent of your own mind, observing the first feature play out. First feature is a waking state. Jagrat Avastha. Jagrat Avastha means waking state. You are the Jagrat Avastha Sakshi. You are the witness of whatever takes place during this waking state. Then, after this waking state comes to an end, what comes next? Swapna Avastha, dream state. And in the dream state, you remain as a conscious observer of everything that happens while you're dreaming. And you may have many dreams, fine. Whatever happens in all of those dreams happen in your mind. They are all known to you. They're all known by you. You are that conscious observer. You are the awareful witness, observing as these dreams come and go. You are the Swapna Avastha Sakshi. You are the witness of whatever happens during your dream state. All right, so now imagine being in a theater. You watch the first feature beginning to end. You watch the second feature beginning to end. And then the second feature is now coming to the end. The credits are rolling off the screen. And as the last credit rolls off the screen goes dark. The theater is dark. The soundtrack comes to an end. Imagine being in a pitch black, silent theater. Your eyes are wide open. What do you see? Do you see? In that dark theater, do you have the power of sight? Sure you do. Do you have the power of hearing? Sure you do. What do you see? Nothing. What do you hear? Nothing. What are we describing? Deep sleep. Dreamless sleep. You are the Sakshi, the observer of whatever happens during the waking state. You are the Sakshi, the observer of whatever happens during your dream state. You are the Sakshi, the observer during deep sleep. You are the observer of the silence of your own mind. It's like looking at that dark screen. When you look at the dark screen, you see. It's not like your power of sight went away. Looking at that dark screen, you see. What do you see? Nothing. Can I ask the question now? You're conscious of whatever happens to you while you're awake. You're conscious of whatever happens in your mind during a dream. And then in deep sleep, do you really become unconscious? Or are you conscious, but there's nothing to see? We make this fundamental error in our thinking. We think that deep sleep is a state of unconsciousness. The ancient rishis said, no way. They said it's ridiculous that you could be unconscious at any time, in any situation. They look at it like this. You're aware every moment throughout the day. You're aware every moment during a dream. your consciousness is always there on, observing. And then, as your mind becomes more quiet and more quiet, as you're drifting off into deep sleep or in between your dreams, you observe the dreams coming and going, you observe the mind becoming quieter and quieter and quieter, then suddenly, you, the conscious observer, cease to exist. Huh? Does that make sense? Does it make sense for things to come and go? Yes. Does it make sense for I to blink in and out of existence? Doesn't make sense. Sri Shankaracharya used this really powerful expression. He said that your true nature as observer, Sri Shankara said, you are alupta drik. Drik means seer. Alupta, one who never lose sight. You never blink. An unblinking observer. When I use that expression, I still remember Pujya Swami Dayananda coming. He invented an alupta drik mudra. You know, in Hinduism, we use many of these mudras, symbols of our hands. You know, this one, blessings, don't be afraid. This one, giving you whatever, fulfilling your wishes. This one, associated with the teacher and teaching. There are so many mudras like this. So Pujya Swami Dayananda invented a new one. You won't find this in any manual anywhere. He called it the Alupta Drik Mudra, the Unblinking Observer Mudra. What was that? He did this class after class, and I'm doing it for you now because it's vivid. Alupta Drik. Unblinking observer, and the point he was making, he was explaining to us the teachings of Sri Shankaracharya, who explained that your capacity to observe is alupta. It never goes away. While you're awake, you're observing everything that takes place. Again, it's taking place not outside, it's taking place here in your own mind. During a dream, you're observing whatever happens during a dream. And then in deep sleep, as alupta drik, as the unblinking observer, during deep sleep, dreamless sleep, sushupti avastha, during that condition, you observe the absence of activity in your own mind. It's like standing in a pitch black closet with your eyes wide open. You see, but there's nothing to be seen. In sushupti avastha, you are conscious. There's nothing to be conscious of. Therefore, it's all dark. But you wrongly conclude that you are unconscious in deep sleep. This is a wrong conclusion. It's an unfounded conclusion. And if you argue, but Swamiji, that's counterintuitive. Everyone knows we're unconscious in deep sleep. Even when I go for, if I have an operation, the guy administers, anesthesiologist administers anesthesia, and he says, you were unconscious, Swamiji, during an operation. I didn't experience anything. Oh. How do you know you didn't experience anything? How do you know? What an interesting question. How will you answer that? Swamiji, I know. I know I didn't experience. How do you know? In order to know that you didn't experience anything, you had to be there observing that there was nothing. Honestly, this is what it is. It's just, this is so important. Let's take two more minutes because this, by the way, was something that as a young Vedanta student, I really struggled with this one. I struggled with this a lot. I used to think, well, wait a minute, you know, science tells me that consciousness is a function of brain activity, blah, blah, blah. I had a very scientific orientation, and at first thought this looked like it was contrary to science, it looked like it was counterintuitive, it looked like there was something wrong. Absolutely not true. Here's how to establish it. The best way is this kind of story I made up. Suppose we were all together, not in this lecture hall, but we were all together in some room with no windows. Imagine we're all sitting together in a windowless room, and then suddenly, black, pitch black. How would you explain that? Well, there are actually two explanations. One explanation is we all went blind simultaneously. Possible. We all went, there are probably 200 of us here. So 200 of us, we all went blind simultaneously is one explanation. The other explanation is the lights went off and there was nothing to see. But suppose the lights are off and we get into a big argument now. Which is it? Imagine that we're sitting in this pitch black room arguing about are we all blind or have the lights gone out? Tell me, while you're sitting in that black room, would there be any way of proving one or the other? No. Sitting in the darkness, there's no way you can prove whether or not we're all blind. There's no way you can prove that the lights went off. You don't know. Then, a few minutes later, we see again. Wonderful. Now, we can get into another argument because there are two possibilities. One possibility is the lights went back on. The other possibility is all 200 of us suddenly and simultaneously regained our power of sight. Right? Notice both explanations work. Absolutely. Both, logically speaking, both work. Tell me, which one is more intuitive? I mean, is there any doubt? Just intuitively, one is right and one is wrong. Now, the point I'm making is here, intuition is a pretty good guide. You say, it's ridiculous to imagine that we all went blind. It's so easy to say that we could see there was nothing to be seen. Now watch this. Throughout this day, you witness thousands and thousands of events taking place in your mind. Vrittis. Vritti is a mental event. Everything you see is a vritti. Anything you hear, taste, touch, or smell, vritti. Every thought is a vritti. Every emotion is a vritti. Every little thing you experience is a vritti. In the course of a day, you must witness thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions and millions of vrittis come and go in the course of a day. You observe every one of those vrittis as Alupta-drik. Then comes dream state. While you're dreaming, more vrittis. You go on in a vritti, you continue, notice in dreams, you still see, can you see things in a dream? Hear, taste, touch, and smell? Sure. Even though your eyes are closed and you're in a quiet bedroom, you go on seeing and hearing things. Isn't that more evidence that everything we experience is only in our mind? That's a fact. The only difference is, during the day, the eyes get involved and ears get involved. In a dream, the eyes and ears aren't involved, but you go on seeing and hearing. All right, fine. So during a dream, thousands, millions of vrittis come and go, and you observe each and every one of those. Now, listen carefully. This is all set up. All day long, you are aluptadrik, observing each and every one of his millions of vrittis. As you're dreaming, you are aluptadrik, observing each one of the millions of dream vrittis as they come and go. And then in deep sleep, suddenly, you go unconscious. Huh? That's like saying we all simultaneously went blind. Which is to say, it's logically possible that in deep sleep you are unconscious. Logic supports the possibility that you are unconscious in deep sleep. Common sense says it's ridiculous. If you are observing everything that happens while you're awake, if you're observing everything that happens while you're dreaming, common sense dictates that in deep sleep, you go on observing. There's just nothing to observe. What we've just developed is how the ancient rishis understood you as chit-atma. The awareful self, chidatma. You, chidatma, awareful self, conscious self, consciousness. This is ultimately the meaning of the pronoun I, aham. Who are you? You are a conscious being, a conscious observer. We'll develop that a little bit further in just a moment. Let's finish up this movie theater analogy. Remember the metaphor? Double feature movie? So now you're in a dark theater. Can you see? Yep. What do you see? Nothing. Suppose you sit in that theater long enough. Then what will happen? The next show will begin. Which means they'll show the first feature again. And then they'll show the second feature again. And then what will you see next? The screen going dark. Suppose you stayed in that theater all day long. You're a real movie lover. So in that theater, what would you observe? First feature, second feature, dark screen. First feature, second feature, dark screen. You're sitting in the theater observing the sequence of first feature, second feature, dark screen. It repeats again and again and again. In the same way, you as chidatma, you as a conscious self, as a conscious being, what do you observe? You observe waking state, dream state, followed by the darkness of deep sleep. Then what comes? Next waking state, dream state, deep sleep. In a movie theater, you keep watching that cycle, first feature, second feature, dark screen. In our lives, we keep watching the cycle, observing the cycle, waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, repeating again and again, swapna, jagrat, sushupti, back, swapna, jagrat, swapna, sushupti, waking state, dream state, deep sleep, goes back, jagrat, swapna, sushupti, jagrat, swapna, sushupti. Isn't that what we've been watching all these days? Years? Decades? Decades! Now, finish this metaphor off. And this is the fun part. Suppose this person we're talking about is a real movie addict. They stay. They actually live in this theater. And day after day, they go on observing. First feature, second feature, dark screen. This goes on. They stay in this theater for 70 years. 70 years in the theater. And then the theater burns down. Interesting. Theater is burnt down. Now they're in a non-theater, looking at a non-screen. Everything is dark. But they see. What do they see? No screen. Can you tell the difference between seeing a black screen and seeing a non-existent screen? Would be more or less the same, right? Between seeing a black screen and seeing a non-existent screen, there's nothing to see. What is the difference between the experience of deep sleep and the experience of death, because that's what the metaphor is. After 70 years, the theater burns down. What happened to the fellow watching all these movies? The theater burned down. He's still sitting there. The blessed theater burned down. There's no screen, and he's sitting there. I guess his popcorn, maybe. You'd keep him going. I don't know. First he's watching first feature, second feature, dark screen. Now he's watching no screen. This is death. And to finish this metaphor off to its ridiculous conclusion, this fellow is such a lover of movies. What does he do? He finds another theater. Moves in. And here we go again. First feature, second feature, dark screen. This is a little hint at perhaps in reincarnation. After this body goes, then you go and find another body, and the whole thing starts over and over again. The message of these metaphors should be clear then. Who you are is an observer, utterly unaffected by everything you observe. And that utterly unaffected is so important. In the movie theater, things seem to affect you. They don't really affect you. I have to get my prop out again. Some of you weren't here last week when I gave this famous example. The example of my orange crystal. You know, it's not orange. Does it look orange? Sure, it looks orange. It's not orange. It seems orange. It appears orange. Your experience tells you it's orange. Your knowledge tells you it's clear. Your experience tells you that everything that happens to you in life seems to affect you, just like the crystal seems orange. But the fact is that the crystal is utterly unaffected by the orangeness of a cloth, in the same way you, as Chidatma, as the consciousness, the awareful observer, you are utterly unaffected by everything that happens in your life. You say, but, come on, how much is this crystal affected? And we had this discussion last week, but it's one of the most important discussions. We have grown too reliant on our simple experience to tell us what's true. Experience fools us all the time. We spent a long time talking about the sunset in the last class. Today, you go outside and look at the blue sky. Wait a minute, what color is air? Air is blue? Does air have a blue tint to it? No. What color is the sky? Blue. Yep, experience fools us. Can't we? It's too obvious. Experience fools us. You've seen this in so many books. There are actually these little markings on this board, so I can get these dots exactly the same. Because I'm going to draw now two lines. One line. Good. Do they look the same length? But you saw how I constructed them, right? They're exactly the same length. Do they look the same length? No. What in the world is going on here? Experience is unreliable. Our experience is an unreliable indicator of truth, of reality, and we better get it. If we fall into this comfortable conclusion that, you know, it's whatever you see, that's what it is. You know, it's just what you see. If we go through life naive, just blindly accepting our experience at every moment, this is where we get in trouble. The ancient rishis challenge us to re-examine our ordinary experiences and discover where we misinterpret our ordinary experience. You experience two lines. They look the same length. But if I connect these, and if I connect these, you can see, actually I didn't even draw quite straight, they are exactly the same length. The rishis challenged us to re-examine our experience and discover where we've misinterpreted. If you think that this crystal has been affected by orangeness, you've made a mistake. If you think that you have truly been affected by the suffering in your life, you've made the same mistake. Orangeness seems to color the crystal, doesn't truly. Your suffering, your pain, your difficulties, your struggles of life seem to affect us in exactly this way, but they don't truly affect us. You can discover that this crystal is clear and utterly unaffected by anything it comes near. In the same way, you can discover that you, as a kshetrajna, you as that conscious observer, you as that unchanging, unblinking, awareful witness, you can discover that you are utterly unaffected by everything that happens to you in life, and this is where true freedom comes. That's when you can be like that actor, crying, and inside, saying, wonderful, how good I'm doing. The actor can only do that because they know that they are okay, regardless of just having been cursed and kicked, that they're absolutely okay. In life, we all get kicked, plenty. You can discover that you're absolutely okay because none of that truly affects you. Now, again, this subject matter really deserves much, much more. But because we're studying the Bhagavad Gita, we're going to move on to the next verse in our next class. However, obviously, there's so much more of this Vedantic understanding to pursue. Fortunately, our Vedanta classes are resuming. Our Tuesday night Vedanta class will resume in a couple of weeks. And our text will be the Yoga Sutra, which is a text on meditation. But you'll find that in our study of meditation, following the text of Yoga Sutra, you'll find that we come to this understanding. It's a very profound analysis of the mind and consciousness and your relationship between you and your mind. All of that will be discussed in great detail, along with what is meditation, what is samadhi. All of that we'll be discussing in the Tuesday night classes. So it'll be a very different level of study. We went through this way back in chapter 2. I think we did it more elaborately then. If you want to go back, if you missed out on those classes on chapter 2, why don't you go back and get the tapes on chapter 2, verses 11 through 16. That should do it. Maybe 17. 11 through 17, if there are even a few after that. Start with 11. Definitely go through verse 15 at least, and then go on 16, 17 if you can. We treated this in much, much more detail then. I'm torn right now because it's such a profound discussion. I would like to keep going on it, but this is a Bhagavad Gita class, so I think it's appropriate to keep it in proportion. So since this is the study of Bhagavad Gita, when we meet next class, then we'll go on to the next verse. We've done a fairly good job with this, but again, we can spend so much more time with it. All right, before we conclude today's class, several important announcements. Our guest lecture series is starting tomorrow. I'm very happy about